Welcome to Frenzy on the Podcast, right here on Movie City News. Today we have my favorite podcast ever with James Gray, because he is just the most knowledgeable guy about films. He is the director of Two Lovers, which is an excellent movie, came out earlier this year. He also directed We Own the Night, The Yards, and Little Odessa. We're going to talk about all of that and so much more. So give a listen to me and James Gray. So first of all, congratulations. I just saw that you were nominated for Independent Spirit Award.
Thank you.
You and Gwyneth Paltrow were both nominated. Deservedly so. But I was wondering how Joaquin Phoenix could not get nominated. I thought he was so incredible in this movie. I
have no idea. I don't know what the process is on choosing nominees, and it's really, in a way, you have to kind of divorce yourself from the whole thing. And I mean, it's like very nice that I was recognized, and especially Gwyneth. I get happier actually when the actors are nominated than when I do. I mean, that sounds phony, but it's completely true. I don't know quite why that is, but it is true. And well, to whatever degree the picture gets recognized, I'm just thrilled. I mean, about Joaquin, I agree with you. I think his work is amazing, but I'm biased.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, if an actor gets nominated, then that also, I mean, is due in no small part to you. Because, I mean, first of all, you helped get them in the movie, and then you also helped direct them to that performance.
Well, it's true, but it's not true. In the case of both Joaquin and Gwyneth, they are really, I mean, tremendously accomplished. You really have to do...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not to tell too big a secret, because I may be finding myself unemployed as a consequence, but I really don't tell Joaquin or Gwyneth very much. You
right.
sort of let them do what they do. They're really good.
Right. Well, I mean, that's...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, well, that's also, you know, I guess part of, you know, figuring out which actors you need to talk with and which ones you can just kind of let run. And
you know what? I'll take your compliment then. Thank you.
There you go. All right. But yeah, I forgot to say at the beginning of this interview is that I was such a big fan of this film.
Thank you.
When I saw it earlier this year, because it reminded me so much of, and I mean this in the best possible way. I mean, it reminded me so much of a movie from the 70s.
Right.
Not just the story, but the look of the film. And I was wondering if that was something that you were aiming for, and if you and your cinematographer perhaps had a few conversations about the look of the film and which films you might have, you know, looked at as antecedents. Stuff like that. That's like eight questions in one. But
well, no, it's a good question. I mean, we didn't. I never talked about the film being, you know, 70s in style. But that doesn't mean you're wrong. In fact, it's totally my taste.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's what I like. It's what I like about. It's my interest in movies is from that period.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of European pictures from the 50s and from the 60s, and that's really what we took our cue from.
And I
guess what happens is that the American pictures of the 70s took their cue from the European movies of the 50s. So I guess in a weird way it wound up looking like those movies.
Mm.
But we talked very much, I mean, I showed, the problem is that when you're looking for a movie that addresses love, desire, really,
yeah.
in a serious way, it's very difficult to find American movies that do that. American movies tend to treat love as a joke, which is the reason we made so many excellent comedies about love. I mean, even going back to the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for it, too. It's actually quite an advanced approach. The American approach is kind of an advanced approach about it, because the state of being in love is ridiculous. So if you approach it with some kind of seriousness of intent, it's, I mean, almost always seems risible. I mean, Shakespeare only did it once, really, in Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other times he did comedies about love. So he was onto something, I think. And I think it's because our behavior and our actions and our attitudes are so ridiculous when we are in heightened states of desire. So in order to look for something that felt authentic and serious about the subject, I had to look to Europe. I had to look to the 50s and 60s movies, particularly the pictures of Fellini and the French New Wave. And I guess the movie wound up looking sort of American 70s because we stole from those guys in the 70s. So I guess that's why it looks that way.
Well, it all.
But it was nobody. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna say. Well, it all kind of goes back to. I mean, we stole from the Europeans in the 50s and the 60s, but they in turn stole from the film noir that we did in the 40s.
Absolutely.
40s and 50s. So it's all like a big. Yeah, it's all a big mess. But I would love to know specifically which European films. I mean, if you know any specific. I mean, I'm.
Yeah, we looked at many. We looked at The Knights of Cabiria, which is, you know, there are many moments where, you know, there's one where Gwyneth and there's one where Joaquin look into the camera, and it's stolen from the ending of Knights of Cabiria. And the idea of Cabiria's emotions mattering so much to her, so they matter to us, that people's emotions are not something that are a source of ridicule, but rather to be honored. And so the character should be honored. And that idea I got very much from those mid-50s Fellini movies. And La Strada, you know, I stole that Anthony Quinn on the beach ending for two lovers towards the end. And also I stole from a picture that isn't 50s, but it's a movie called Late Marriage, which is a wonderful Israeli picture made in, I think, 2002. And I even cast one of the actors from it, Moni Moshanov, which I think is a wonderful little movie. But a certain kind of, dare I say, purity of approach, a kind of no-nonsense approach, a very kind of honest approach with the actors and with the subject matter, which is really what we were going for. And to that degree, you're quite right, the 70s movies in America did do that. They placed a real focus on character and narrative, as opposed to sort of the thrills and chills, I think.
Well, you you're going to make me go back and look at Knights of Cabiria again. I've never been a huge Fellini fan.
Oh, no, it's a masterpiece. I mean, the movie is about as good as a movie can get, and it's great for the reason that I think I was talking about, the idea that there is no distance between you and Cabiria, and he has the complete compassion that he has for her as a person. It's a beautiful, beautiful film as a consequence. I mean, just beautiful. And Fellini's style really changed. So you might, when we think of Fellini, we think, you know, 8½ and Juliet of the Spirits. We sort of think of the later stuff, La Dolce Vita. We think of the stuff which gets a little surreal.
Well, I do, I mean, of all the Fellini films I've seen, I mean, I always liked La Strada the best.
But, right, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You like the more neorealist stuff.
Right. Well, but the thing is, you know, I always think there's kind of a dividing line between people who prefer the Italian neorealist and those who prefer the French New Wave. And I always kind of preferred the French New Wave to because I don't know, even like Rossellini never really worked for me. I don't know what it is. I just can't like bridge that gap, I guess.
Does this mean I'm like a freak of nature then? Because I love both. Well, I think 400 Blows is unbelievable.
Well, that's my favorite.
Time, like, scroll.
Yeah, well,
400 Blows is your favorite?
400 Blows and the entire Antoine Doinel series, like, taken as one movie, I think is the greatest accomplishment in motion picture history. But
well, I tell you, I think that, I've seen all of them, too. I love them. Have you ever seen them? Stolen Kisses might be. It's certainly up there. I mean,
I like Bed and Board a lot.
Bed and Board?
Yeah, and I do think Love on the Run is. I mean, I just think they're all. I mean, it's all one long story, so it's really hard to kind of pinpoint which one is best, I think.
Right, right.
Although Stolen Kisses, I mean, they're all masterpieces.
So. Isn't Stolen Kisses the one where he looks in the mirror and goes, Antoine Donnell, Antoine Donnell, Antoine Donnell?
Mm-hmm. And Christine Vaubon, or whatever her name is. Christine, yeah. That's the one.
But that's amazing.
It's just, yeah. Anyway, sorry about that.
And I love, you know what else I love? I think Contempt.
Oh, Contempt is my, that's my favorite Godard.
Fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Fantastic. It's my favorite Godard. I love Viva Savi as well, but Contempt is the real masterpiece.
I think so.
Because it's so, it's like, it's unique and formally adventurous, but at the same time, it's like, here is my emotion, and I'm just going to put it out there on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can tell, it's about his relationship with Anna Karenina. It's amazing. Amazing film.
Well, I think it's amazing because, you know, there's the Godard of Breathless and Band of Outsiders, which are kind of more traditional narratives, and then you have the Godard of later years, which I don't, you know, I never really got into the later Godard, like Weekend, I thought was kind
right.
of unwatchable almost.
It's didactic, yeah. It's very didactic.
But
it is.
But Contempt is the perfect Godard film, you know, it's
yeah.
just, it is that perfect marriage of a little bit out there with real emotions, like that long scene, like you said, of Brigitte Bardot, and oh God, who's the actor? Is it
Michel Piccoli?
When the two of them are having that really long drawn out argument, I mean, that just hits so close to home. You know, it's
amazing.
Just anyway,
for half an hour in that apartment.
Exactly.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
All right, so back to Two Lovers, which
yes.
is another great film. I wanted to go back to something you mentioned about, you know, how Shakespeare only made one love story, you know, Romeo and Juliet, that wasn't a comedy. And, you know, but I was thinking, you know, a lot of Shakespeare's works are also about family. And I think that seems to be a this is the most awkward segue, but I think that seems to be a running theme in your work. Family plays a huge part, you know, and each of your films seems to view family as like some sort of support system or a catalyst for getting your life back on track. And I wanted to know, like, well, I guess how much your family influenced that and why that is a you know, such a big theme for you.
Well, it's the most elemental and basic of human relationships, family life. I mean, there's the first person you meet is your mother, right?
Mm.
And it's the least dated element in a movie. And what you're trying to do, at least certainly what I'm trying to do, I don't know if others are trying to explain, most of them are, I think. I'm trying to make something that lasts, that you can watch 10, 20, 30 years from now and will still make a bit of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think family relationships have changed. I mean, in thousands of years, I don't think they've ever changed. Look at the Greeks are completely relevant today, and that's all they wrote about. It's such a direct path to the human emotions, your relationships with your mother and your father, your brother, your sister. The thing is it also is that it is a perfect representation, a perfect microcosm of the world at large.
Mm.
And family is about love, but it is also about hate. And just as surely as family provides great emotional support for us, it can also destroy our dreams.
Yeah.
So you have tremendous possibilities, tremendous dramatic possibilities inherent in a situation in which there is both love and hate, and both support and fear at the same time. It's really tremendous. So you that's why I mine it, because it's life in all of its complexities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, great movies, not that I would be an expert in that, but great movies, I think, tend to be a kind of a marriage of love and death, right? Both elements being there somewhere. And that even in Fred Astaire, you know, as beautiful as Fred Astaire is, and you think, well, that doesn't have any death in it. but he's dancing in a way that is beyond the infinite. I mean, you nobody can move like he can. Not even Fred Astaire, he needed multiple takes. So he's suggesting to you an unattainable infinite. And in that, the film contains a kind of melancholy, which is why they're so beautiful.
Yeah.
So Family, that's Fred Astaire movies, I'm going on a tangent, but Family, that central relationships that we all have, I think lends itself greatest, in a great way, to that kind of duality, that great complexity that we're trying to go for as filmmakers.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting in your film, because I think family also represents permanence, you know, because your family is always going to be your family, and I think that there's a really, I mean, Leonard's love in the film for either Sandra or Michelle, or his lust for them, is ultimately, you know, fleeting, possibly, but his family, their love for him, is never-ending.
Right, and it's different, right? The relationship he has with his mother is different than it is with either of the two ladies that he's dealing with. Of course, I mean, you ask if this is derived from some kind of personal place, and one would hope that it is. It's not autobiographical. My life is absolutely nothing like Leonard's. But you know, you're just always stealing from some personal place, something that you really care about very deeply.
Right.
And that does matter. That is very much a kind of a key for me as a filmmaker. I think it's very important to try and make the picture personal. Mm-hmm. You know, best advice I ever got, you know, Francis Coppola once said to me, he said, make it personal. He said, there's only one of you.
Hmm.
You know, which I thought was so great. I mean, it's like, you know, it's true. There's only one of you. And if you make it personal, then something hopefully interesting and original will develop. Your voice will come through.
Wow.
I shouldn't say original. Original is sort of overrated, right? Who cares whether it's original or not?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing. I mean, your film, I mean, the narrative is almost pretty traditional in the sense that, you know, it's, you know, guys trying to choose between two girls, but...
Right.
But
we're... Although it is, and I would argue, by the way, with you, that I think that your appraisal is not wrong, but it's interesting because... There is the basic form of it, which is a guy and choosing two girls, but he doesn't really choose. He can't really choose. There's no choice involved.
Well, that's the interesting thing, I think, and that's how. I mean, because he is not. I mean, he's reactive, you know, and I think that because of who Leonard is, we're kind of completely uncertain of how things are going to play out, you know.
Right.
And I think that is. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, to feel like, okay, I feel like I'm in familiar territory plot-wise, and then feel like from moment to moment that, wow, I am not in familiar territory at all is really amazing.
Well, what you're trying to do is you're trying to set up a kind of an archetypal situation and then tear it down. So if... You have a guy caught between two women, but then you find out, of course, that Gwyneth really wants nothing to do with him sexually, and then so he's not choosing between her. And then there's this other woman who is sort of almost being imposed on him by culture and family and other elements. And then, of course, you've got his own fractured and very deeply disturbed personality. And so you don't know which way he can turn. So you've got your basic... core story, which is very simple. And simple, by the way, is not the same thing as easy.
Right.
An easy story means, you know, what you're talking about, which is every turn, you kind of not only know what's going to happen, because that, you know, again, nobody really cares about predictability, even though they say they do, but you understand why, and it's as a consequence, it's not interesting.
Yeah.
The predictability, which actually, in a way, is important, you almost want an air of predictability. Well, certainly I do. Some people go to the movies for different reasons. Some people go because they say, well, they want to know what's around every corner and they want to be surprised. But the standard for movies is, in that case, much lower than it is for other forms of art, because you don't go to the theater and say, well, I'm going to watch King Lear and then maybe this time all of his daughters will get together and they'll have a party at the end. I mean, you know exactly the way it's going to end.
Right.
And the Greeks, you know, and the they had a guy who would come out in the beginning and say, Henry the Fourth, Prince Hal stands up and says in the beginning of the play, I'm going to be the king at the end of the play. So just watch the play and know that at the end I'll be the king, okay? And then he basically goes back to the play. Because the whole idea of not knowing what comes next was incredibly banal to them.
Yeah.
What was interesting was how it happens, why it happens.
Well, so, I think there's no chance in your film that, say, aliens are going to come and kidnap everybody.
Right.
So it's not unpredictable in that sense, but it is unpredictable from moment to moment, what is Leonard going to do? And then he takes the subway to Manhattan and follows her, and it's, I couldn't expect that moment, but if you show me the larger arc of things, I could say, well, probably at the end of the movie, he's going to wind up with one of them.
Right. Well, then the movie worked for you because that's exactly what I was trying to do. That what you're talking about is there is an air of inevitability over the story, but in the moment-to-moment details, you were wondering about the next step. Mm-hmm. It's also, of course, it's a big narrative cheat that I did. But you got a guy trying to kill himself in the first minute of the movie. You're in for something that you don't know what could happen with that guy.
Yeah, that's true. But I think it's interesting that, you set it up so that there is really no possible happy ending for him. Because
That's true.
Even the ending that he gets, I've been thinking about it for the months following, because at the time I was like, well, like good for him, he winds up, with somebody. But now that I think about it, I think about, well, he's most likely going to be profoundly unhappy with this person.
I don't know if Michelle would have afforded him happiness either, but what I was trying to do with the ending, and I don't know if this is something that comes across, but because I've read people say, it's a falsely happy ending. I was never going for a happy ending, but I wasn't going for a sad one either.
Yeah.
I was trying to do both the bitter and the sweet, really.
Mm-hmm.
That there were two sides to the same coin,
Yeah.
That there was both, how do I put this? That there was both love and, it was bittersweet, that there was both love and disappointment at the same time. Because isn't that sort of like life, right?
Yeah.
See, I've made this mistake in my own work at other times, where you go too far to one side, and that's what makes movie endings so challenging, because you do something that's completely dark and then it seems almost gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do something upbeat, it seems fake, phony, because life doesn't end like that. So what you're trying to do is acknowledge both sides. And if you can do that, I think that's really a true calling.
Well, I think, it seems like he's settling in the end, because this is available, and he knows that he's going to receive love from this person. And it's the opposite of the promise of a life with Michelle, which is, constant frivolity and excitement. And
true.
And so I thought it was wonderfully done. And
thank you.
One of my other favorite films this year, by the way, speaking of Francis Ford Coppola, was Tetro. Did you get a chance to see that?
I did. I saw it in Cannes. It played at the director's fortnight, and I saw it there.
That was
a big Francis Coppola fan. So
yeah, he still got it. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about your other films, because I've been a really big fan of yours ever since I saw Little Odessa when I was, I guess, 11 or 12 on cable, and I was like, this movie is amazing, and who is this guy? And then 6 years later, The Yards came out, and I was like, oh my God, it's the guy who did Little Odessa. It was like an event for me. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about what, looking back on your films now, what is your favorite of your films?
Well, it's hard to respond to that because it's sort of like asking which of your kids is your favorite. I have weird favorites.
Right.
I don't have favorite movies of mine. First of all, I haven't seen either Little Odessa or The Yards for many years. And I what happens generally is that I have things that I think I really screwed up in each of the movies, and then things that I think came off very well in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that, you know, my last movie before Two Lovers, I did a movie called We Own the Night, which has my two favorite things I've ever done as a filmmaker. But there are other things in it that bother me that I think are weak threads. But then there are things in The Yards I love and things in The Yards I think I screwed up. Little Odessa, I think I screwed up some things. You know what I mean? It's hard to say. It's like I don't really look at it. I look at it more like which of the films has the most, is the closest to what it is that I had in mind. And in that way, it's probably Two Lovers. The Two Lovers is probably the closest film I've done to the one that I originally had in my head. And that's really, you can't ask for much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a really great situation on it. I had very wonderful actors, and I had complete creative control. I had Final Cut, you know, finally, and I was really able to make the film exactly the way I wanted it. And that was a big advantage, you know. I was really relaxed while filming it because I never worried about being fired or having to be recut or whatever. And I think I entered a more, I don't want to say zen-like, but I mean, you know, a more relaxed kind of place I was actually making the film. So in that sense, probably Two Lovers is my favorite.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are things in each of the films, you know.
It's funny, you know, I asked Lukas Moodysson, the Swedish director, the same question.
I know who he is, sure.
Yeah, he's a fantastic filmmaker, and he answered the question the exact same way, about which one has the least amount of mistakes in it.
It's hard to say. It really is hard to say, isn't it? You have no distance.
I know, it's a dumb question.
It's not a dumb question. It's a good one, because it enables some kind of debate in a way. It's like what you're trying to do. The closest I've ever come, for example, to doing something exactly as I had pictured it,
mm-hmm.
is probably there's a scene in the last film I did in which Joaquin Phoenix goes into this narcotics den, this drug den.
Mm, that's a good
and
scene.
He gets involved. I don't know if you've seen the movie. There's this terrible shootout, and his ears start to ring. He jumps out the window. That's the closest I've come to what it is I originally had in mind, tried to achieve. Now, there were other things in that film that, you know, bothered me, or I was subject to schedule issues or whatever, but that was something that at least I thought, oh, well, that fulfills what it is I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a soft spot in my heart for that, and then other people have come to me and say that's their least favorite film that I've done. So, I don't know, The Yards has a fight between Joaquin Phoenix and Mark Wahlberg, which I think is one of the better things I've put on film.
That's a great
scene. But then again, also that movie has problems, you know. Little Odessa I remember least. Little Odessa is pretty far away from me now, and that's, what is that, 1994, 95? I was very young when I made it, and I think I was 23 when I started shooting it, and we had just a brutal schedule. It was shot in about 21 days or something, and one of the coldest winters in New York, but that sort of helped the picture. It sort of informed the picture. And then, my memory of it is very, very dim. So, I mean, to the extent that I can talk about it even, I'd have to see it again.
Well, that'd be interesting to watch it again now. Maybe it'll be like watching another filmmaker's movie.
Well, I had a chance. They did a retrospective of my films last year in France at the Cinémathèque, and they invited me there, and I did Q&As after each of the films, and then did this masterclass thing. And they showed the Little Odessa was first, and they got a brand new print of it. And they said, "Would you like to stay?" And I said, "Okay, I haven't seen it in a while. If I'm going to have to do a Q&A after, I'd like to remember what the heck it is I did." And then, about 3 minutes into the film, I kind of couldn't stand it. I had to leave. Because you start seeing the mistakes. You start seeing, oh, well, why didn't I put the camera 3 inches to the left? That would have made a better shot. Or, you know, this is too long. I held this shot too long. I held it and didn't do this. You know what I mean? It's you can't really revisit it.
Yeah.
So you think you would, because it's been, you know, 15, 16, 17 years or whatever since I made it. But you kind of can't. You know, you kind of can't revisit that stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess it's one of those things that you kind of block out because of, I mean, 21 days shooting in brutal cold. I mean, it might be an experience you might not want to remember.
It was an awful, awful shoot. I mean, we had great actors. I loved those guys, and they were really cooperative and everything. But the physical, the arduous nature of the shoot, it was so unpleasant. I remember it. It was just awful.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never had a lengthy schedule, so I've never been able to sort of relax. The funny thing is, the most relaxed in terms of time that I've ever been was the car chase sequence in We Own the Night, because I basically, we had all this time, we had 6 days or whatever, and so, you know, you would spend hours on a shot where Joaquin Phoenix would have to turn around or something. So, you know, you would make sure that you got it the way you wanted it, and that they allowed a lot of time for. Everything else, you know, they think it's harder to do that than it is to have a intimate scene between two people, and that's just not true.
Yeah. Well, that is a great car chase scene, though.
Thanks.
But yeah, well, I know you're kind of busy, so I wanted to ask you one last question. This is something, something that I ask everybody, and I'm very curious to hear your thoughts, which is, what is your favorite film of all time, or at least what is the film that had the biggest influence on you?
Wow.
I mean, you could have more than one.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly love, I mean, we talked about Knights of Cabiria. That was a big influence. I mean, I tell you, I really love this Visconti movie called Rocco and His Brothers.
Mm.
That was a big moment for me, that movie. Did you ever see that movie?
I never saw that one. I'm writing it down right now.
It is an amazing film, a Luchino Visconti movie, 1960. And it's quite remarkable. And it has an absolutely devastating, I mean, I cannot even want to tell you about it, because what will happen is you'll be watching the film, and for the first, like, hour of the movie, I know what's going to happen with you. You're going to watch it, and you're going to be like, wait, why am I watching this? Like, why does he like this movie? It's about five brothers who migrate from the south of Italy to the north.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the agrarian south to the industrial north, and, you know, Italy regards the south as, you know, the northerners regard the southerners as, like, you know, white people regarded black people in the United States,
right,
in the 40s or something, you know. And the prejudice and the kind of the devastating effects of the industrial north on the family. And what happens really is that two brothers fall in love with the same woman. I'm not going to tell you anything more than that, but the picture has tremendous impact. It was clearly a big inspiration for Francis Coppola, for The Godfather, and for Tetro, and for many other things that he's done. And obviously Marty Scorsese loves it, because Raging Bull follows the pattern a lot. You know, the brothers get into boxing, which is the ultimate kind of self-destructive thing. And it's an amazing film. I mean, a masterpiece, really. And that film really, really changed the way I looked at movies, because it was the perfect marriage of narrative and character, and, of course, a tremendous interest in history and economics and social class, how all these things, and family, of course, too, and how all these things get into the mix in making us who we are. A masterpiece of a movie. He also did a great film called The Leopard. But this
The
one
Leopard
I've
seen, yeah.
Yeah.
But, wow.
This one's, I think, greater. I think it's greater than The Leopard.
I mean, you sold me. I'm going to, I think, run out and buy it as soon as possible.
Well, maybe you'll hate it. Maybe you'll be like, wow, he's wrong.
Well, we do disagree on Fellini, so it's possible, but...
But, you know, I don't think we do disagree on Fellini. I think that if you looked at the stuff that I love, is the La Strada, Knights of Cabiria, Il Bidone, I think is an amazing movie, and I love I Vitelloni. I don't know if you've seen Il Bidone. That's his darkest movie. You might love it.
I have not seen that.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Broderick Crawford plays a con man who dresses up as a priest and basically cheats people into giving him money. And it's Fellini's darkest movie. It has none of the kind of flights of fancy and whimsy that that the later pictures do, and it has none of the surreality. It's a very dark, very interesting picture, and you might love it. I think it's pretty great. I love Evie Deloney too. So if you check those out, and if you hate those, then I'm definitely in a different camp than you.
The surreal nature of Fellini, you know, isn't bothersome to me in and of itself. I mean, I love Buñuel. I mean, who is as surreal as it gets. I just saw that Obscure Object of Desire, which was so unbelievably good.
That's great. I haven't seen that in years.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah, it is. It is a great film.
But I just felt like Fellini, when he veered into the surreal, it just didn't work for me the same way that I
understand.
Yeah.
Try these other films, and then you let me know.
Okay, I will. But
you might not like Rocco. Rocco is interesting because if you're not a big Italian cinema guy, you might not like it. But it is, on the other hand, it's like the film itself is almost like a history of Italian cinema. It sort of starts in a very neorealist way that's very dry, and you might not like that. And then it becomes very dramatic. And about midway through the picture, there is one of the great set pieces in movie history. And it's one of those amazing moments where you realize, oh, I understand why I have been watching everything I would have been watching for the first hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it contextualizes all that stuff. And then after that set piece, the picture becomes more and more dramatic and almost becomes melodrama. And then the end of the movie, which I think melodrama, by the way, can be a beautiful thing. And then at the end of the movie, it goes beyond melodrama. It almost becomes like opera. It might be almost too much for some people. But if you've got a brother, it's about as painful a movie to watch as you can imagine.
Well, I do have a brother, and every movie about brothers usually affects me very deeply in some way.
Oh, how could it not, yeah.
But that experience that you just described, I mean, I remember having the same experience when I was watching Fanny and Alexander.
Amazing movie.
Which is now one of my favorite films of all time. But I remember watching it at the time, and there's the Christmas party, you know, takes up the first hour of the film. And I was like,
right.
I was like, what are we doing here? And then after everything that comes after that, I was like, oh, that scene, that first hour totally works, and I didn't realize it.
Yeah, that's the most satisfying way to watch a picture. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a satisfying experience when you can watch a picture and you all of a sudden realize that all those little details seem to really matter in the big scheme now.
Yep.
It's an amazing and rewarding way to see a picture. It really is.
Absolutely. All right. Well, what's next for you, by the way? Do you know what your next project's going to be?
No, I'm not entirely certain. I've just finished writing a script, which Brad Pitt wants to do about an explorer named Percy Fawcett. It's based on a book called The Lost City of Z.
Mm.
An amazing story. Remains to be seen whether we can get it made. I think we've got a shot, and it's quite unlike anything I've done, and yet exactly the same. You know, it turns out to be. But it's so, you know, it has David Lean elements, but it's it's got much more kind of it's sort of like if you cross David Lean and Werner Herzog. You know, he goes down to the Amazon and essentially goes mad in the jungle.
That sounds great.
And he was based on a real guy, by the way. I mean, it's the real version, real life version of Indiana Jones, even down to the fedora he used to wear. And he was a very handsome man. He was very dashing. Looked, guess what, like Brad Pitt. I mean, he was blonde, very handsome guy. And but he was slightly off, you know. And he went down to the jungle, and he was sent there to map territories, and then very quickly lost all interest in mapping and became very obsessed with finding this city of Z that he called it, El Dorado, Lost City of Gold.
Mm-hmm.
Wound up bringing his own son with him to the jungle to find it, and they were never seen again. They were most likely eaten.
Well, that does sound very, you know, it sounds a little bit like Aguirre.
It has Aguirre overtones, but the picture is more, it has some of that,
mm-hmm.
but it is, my ambition is not to treat it like Herzog did, although I think that film is a masterpiece.
Oh, but yeah.
My ambition is to treat it almost like IMAX or something. Like The Jungle is the only time that he ever felt alive. And so life back home is almost going to be shot Super 16, like an old photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place in 1906. And then when he goes into the jungle, it's like beyond beautiful.
That sounds great. I want to see that movie now. So.
Well, I just finished writing it, and Pitt's on board, and we'll see if I can raise the money.
Wow. Well,
it's a tough time, you know. It's a tough time. These are really tough times. And it's all I can do to not go and direct something that's pretty bad and cheesy just to keep my family afloat, because the audience right now anyway is just not there for the type of pictures that we're talking about. It just isn't. So it's up to me really to square the circle, to give a certain entertainment value, if you will, with what are the themes that I like to explore in a certain, well, to be open about it, a certain darkness.
Yeah. Well, I think...
So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think you're right, unfortunately. But, I don't know. You know, it's... I mean, I look at a film like, you know, Precious is not necessarily a film that would seem to be appealing to mass audiences, but it's doing very well. So you know,
that's true. You never know, and that's the thing that's great about the movie business is what's terrible about the movie business.
Mm.
And it's why the conglomerates should not be in it, because you don't know. It's not like, you know, you make a car and it breaks down. You know that eventually it's not going to sell very well. But if it's a reliable car, the Corolla, right?
Mm-hmm.
People will buy it till the cows come home because they need it and they don't want it to break down on the road in the middle of Thanksgiving. So it'll sell well. A movie is not like that.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to hit. So we can be having this conversation and it can be bleak and miserable. The only movie that does any business is Transformers 2, and we're sitting here going, good God, what are we going to do? And then on a dime, it changes.
Yep. Well, I think that that's...
I'm sorry.
No, but that's the thing, you know, is that I think that... I mean, last year, Slumdog Millionaire wins Best Picture. It's a film with an all-Indian cast. Like, who would have predicted that? It was going to go straight to video. You know?
That's right. Nobody knows.
It's...
Well, Two Lovers was going to go straight to video.
Ugh.
They didn't know that... you know, it was in Cannes, and it didn't win anything, which, by the way, I don't care about at all. I mean, I'm in competition there. It's a wonderful honor. It really is.
Yeah.
There are very few other movies. But the picture, you know, got some very good response from the American press, but some also very negative response. And Cannes is its own thing. And so the distributors were like, uh-oh, what are we going to do? It's not going to get good reviews when it comes out. So what chance does it have? And then they got more pleasantly surprised when they did press screenings back in the United States and finally decided to give it a theatrical release. And, you know, the picture wound up doing about three times what they thought it would do. So maybe even more than that, actually. So you never know.
Exactly. Anyway, all right. I've taken up enough of your time.
Not at all. I've enjoyed it very much. It's wonderful to talk to somebody who has a real passion for cinema. You know, usually you don't get a chance to do that. And
well,
you know, it's such a great art form, and it's quite sad, really, when you think of all the potential it has and where it still is. It's in its infancy.
Absolutely. Well, we're 100 years and change into it. I mean, it's there's so many places to go.
There certainly are.
So, all right. Well, thank you so much. This was an honor.
Not at all.
So, and good luck with Lost City of Z. I'm looking forward to it, hopefully.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care.
You. Bye-bye.
That's all the time we have for today. James Gray was the greatest guest ever. And you can email me at noah@moviecitynews.com. Take care.